Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Internal Displacement, Urbanization, Food Futures, Reflections on Evolving Global Challenges. I'm delighted to introduce our speaker for today, Isis Nunez Ferreira, who is an award-winning urbanist and international development practitioner. She has spent 17 years working across the globe from sub-Saharan Africa to Central and South America. She is currently the urban lead in the World Food Program, where she developed the first urban strategy of the organization. And previously, she was the head of an interagency service supporting governments and UN agencies in addressing internal displacements in different contexts. Welcome to the podcast, Isis.
Thank you, Romola. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start today's podcast by noting the fact that you recently developed a set of urban recommendations for IDPs for the UN Secretary General's high-level report on urban displacement. So I was wondering if we could start today's conversation by talking about some of this. And specifically, if I could invite you to draw on your work to talk about the obstacles and challenges that IDPs face that are unique in your experience to other people like refugees or migrants or citizens.
Thank you, Romola, for this question. I was quite pleased to see that urbanization is very well referenced in the UN Secretary General agenda on internal displacement and solutions for IDPs. And of course, this was a joint effort with many colleagues. But most importantly, I was pleased because this brings visibility to the experience of at least two and of three IDPs that are actually settled and residing in urban areas that had taken refuge in an urban area. This was not the case in the past, unfortunately. The role of cities in internal displacement was not necessarily discussed, as well as the role of local governments. And most importantly, the experience, the particular experience of IDPs in urban areas. But I think for this discussion, I actually wanted to draw from two very different contexts. And one of them particularly is not as much known and discussed globally. And one of them is Central America. Of course, this is also the region where I come from, where a lot of the internal displacement is actually due to generalized violence. And at the same time, as you see in global trends, many of the IDPs are actually residing in urban areas. Now, I wanted to highlight here a phenomenon that is quite particular in this region, precisely because it's internal displacement by generalized violence. And it's the fact that a lot of this displacement happens within the same city. So it's not necessarily that people are being displaced from a rural to an urban area, but actually within the same city. They're being displaced from a violent neighborhood to another, or from a neighborhood controlled by a specific gang to another neighborhood where they can be protected. It reinforces that invisibility of the person that is being displaced. And I have to mention here that another fact that converges here is that invisibility and being anonymous is actually a protection mechanism for people that are displaced by violence and by threats and persecution in this particular context. They need to remain invisible. And what this makes to the person, to the lived experience of that internally displaced person, is that sometimes they cannot even share with their own neighbors the fact that they've been forcibly displaced by violence. This also precludes internally displaced persons in this context to access community-based mechanisms to get support from their own neighbors. So this is another type of complexity that we see that is quite particular to this type of internal displacement, in particular to cities as well. Another important and interesting aspect of internal displacement in this context is that we see that the majority of groups that are affected are actually women, youth, and children. Of course, because a lot of the violence is linked to gangs that have a very young membership and increasingly younger membership. We see many of the situations that cause the displacement linked to forced recruitment, especially of youth and children. So, of course, we see a huge disruption of families and their family life. We see children that are being forcibly recruited within their schools. And, of course, they end up not having access to education and being able to go to those schools because of the fear of being forcibly recruited. With a part of the work that we did in this region, we spoke with families and mothers particularly that have to send their children when they become teenagers, they have to send them to rural areas and grow up in rural areas to ensure that they don't get forcibly recruited while going to school or living in neighborhoods where violence is rife. So we also see, and I want to point out here as well, the toll that it takes on mental health. This was another aspect that was quite particular for this kind of internal displacement by generalized violence. The toll that it takes on the families, on the parents that are always in fear of young people being at risk, or when they have already been victims of a violent act, the fear of maintaining their invisibility and not being further affected. What I think is interesting as well from internal displacement in this region, and particularly bringing it back to urban as well, is the role of the built environment. One of the phenomena that we see here in this region is the role of property. We see a lot of occupation of property by criminal groups and gangs for different purposes. And of course, when families have to give up their house, one of the most important assets that they have, not only to live, but sometimes as well for their livelihoods, they are not only forcibly displaced, they lose important assets. They have now to start, of course, paying rent somewhere else in an informal settlement. They have to relocate sometimes in the middle of the night or from one day to the other. So this is another important characteristics of this type of internal displacement. And it's important, of course, to understand this in order to respond to IDPs in this region. And again, as I mentioned before, usually when they lose access to their property, they are basically being forcibly displaced, and they do it to another part of the city, many times to informal settlements, to places where they can pay low rents and they can remain relatively invisible. And these are also places that are not well served in terms of basic services, and where they start having additional vulnerabilities as a consequence of this displacement that they suffer. So that's just to show you a bit how different it is and it can be the lived experience of an IDP in this region, and particularly linking it back to cities. The fact that this is a lot of it happens within the cities is also important for policy, important for response, both for humanitarian and development organizations and also for local governments. This really makes it difficult to identify them. It makes it difficult to provide the assistance that is needed and also especially to look for long-term solutions.
Wow, that was really interesting. And I wanted to pick up on a point that you made about looking at it within this particular region. You've done a lot of work in lots of different parts of the world. I was wondering how you compare what you've seen here in Central America with some of the work you've done with IDPs in other parts of the world that you worked in.
Yes, perhaps I can reflect from a very different context from Central America. I think it's good to reflect on situations of protracted displacement, and perhaps I can bring my experience supporting actors in Sudan. Of course, the Sudan conflict, particularly in Darfur, started in 2003. So a lot of time has passed. And as we all know, the situation hasn't been resolved and has changed in the past year or so more drastically. In terms of urban, it's interesting to see how as the conflict evolves, as displacement becomes protracted, also villages, rural areas, and urban areas evolve over time along with displacement. And what you saw in Sudan particularly is that at that time, of course, the camp type of response was the model to address displacement and to protect civilians in conflict. So, of course, across Darfur, there was the proliferation of camps to be able to protect internally displaced persons from the conflict. Some of these camps were actually located next to smaller towns, hubs that had an importance in terms of markets and access to services and so on. They were not in the towns, but they were in the vicinity. As after 15 years, of course, we see these towns growing, becoming more established urban centers, but also the camps themselves start evolving. And in the particular place where I work, we saw two of these camps in the vicinity becoming very much part of the urban fabric. At least in the spatial sense of it, they were right next to each other, very much connecting in terms of land, and the special aspect of it. However, they were disconnected in many other ways. After 15 years, service provision was still not reaching those camps. There was a very clear difference of the services that were provided to the residents of the urban center and the services that people living in the camps had. Mostly these camps were served by humanitarian assistance that had been consistent over all those years. This, of course, creates dependency on humanitarian assistance, which affects which livelihoods and income generation activities internally displaced persons decide to pursue and have access to. What's interesting about these camps is that because they remain their own worlds in themselves, even if connected to the city, especially, they remain very much with their own type of livelihood activities. Many of them, actually, the ones that could actually go back to their land on a seasonal basis, depending on the security situation, they will still go back to be able to grow some vegetables, for example, and be able to eat, be able to sell back that produce back in the city and so on. The ones that could actually go back at certain points in the year, they would go back and then maintain that type of linkage. But many others, it just had to rely on humanitarian assistance. There was very little connection to the opportunities that the urban center could bring to them for many different reasons. Of course, over time, there was a more concerted effort to try to address that disparity. But then comes another problem. When you are trying to integrate IDPs in a particular urban center that at the same time hosts many vulnerable populations, the populations themselves in this urban center, many of them were also not accessing basic services, whether because they couldn't afford it or because they were living in areas of the city that were not served or properly served by basic services. They were living sometimes in poverty without access to many of the opportunities that their own city should give to them. So, of course, there comes this challenge of how do you respond to the IDPs? How do you promote integration of IDPs in this urban center when some of the host communities themselves are in a bad situation? Part of the data that we collected through this collaborative effort also revealed that in some of the criteria, some of the most vulnerable host communities were doing even worse than IDPs in some of the criteria, not in all of them. So here I bring the point that it's very important to never disassociate local integration, durable solutions from the host communities themselves. And in these particular situations where we see the convergence of urban growth, IDPs living in these cities, and at the same time, vulnerability of the host communities increasing, whether because of poverty or other reasons, this is where it is more important to understand and compare the situation of both groups to understand what is particular for IDPs, and then what is a shared challenge for both communities, host communities and IDPs. I think it's very important to have that comparative approach and understand what is particular for each group, because the shared challenges become an opportunity. That's an opportunity, for example, for development projects that can serve all the population groups, but it's also an opportunity to promote social cohesion, to promote better understanding between the different groups, the displaced and the host, and so on. So it has many benefits, but we first need to understand what are our shared challenges across these groups. And then on the other hand, what is specific to the IDPs that requires a tailored approach, whether from humanitarian development actors or from the governments themselves. So I think Sudan, in particular, this case of the camps becoming part of the urban fabric, but still maintaining a bit of separation and not integration, is an important one also to understand. And that shows very much the importance of looking at the convergence of internal displacement, urban growth, and how to better respond to that, for it to become a durable solution for IDPs with benefits for host communities as well. Of course, we talk about very different contexts, Central America and Sudan, but these contexts in terms of internal displacement also have commonalities. And what was particularly important for me, I have very strong interest on gender issues, but also the lived experience of youth in internal displacement. And in the particular case of Sudan, the youth aspect also became quite important and interesting because, as I mentioned before, as camps evolve, as the urban centers grew, as the conflict evolved and the situation of Israel became protracted, people also grew up. In 15 years, many of the people that were born in these camps or were displaced and were children at the time of displacement became young adults in the camps. And then a lot of the times we come into these places thinking that return is the solution. Everyone wants to return. And some of the discussions we had there, we realized that even within the same household, members of the household had different opinions of what return was and if they actually wanted to return or what a durable solution was for them. Sometimes the older members of the household longed to go back to their land and become again farmers and being able to work and make their land productive again in the life that they grew up with. While the younger members actually grew up in a camp with at the very close to a city. For them, of course, the life that they want for themselves is not linked to agricultural production, is not linked to the land where their family was displaced from. So even understanding that at the household level and understanding how protracted displacement affects younger generations and changes their way of looking at solutions, it's also important for us as humanitarian and development actors as well. And I think in Sudan, this also caught my attention on how a solution had a very different meaning for different members of the same household, especially because of the gender and the age difference as well.
Thank you, Isis. Lots of things to unpack there. I wanted to sort of also ask you about the role of food in this work. What do you think the role of food is in that question of displacement?
Thank you, Romola. I'm actually very glad that you asked that question. And not only because, of course, it brings together my previous work on displacement and my current work focused on food security and nutrition, but also because it's hugely important for, as you see now, the type of crisis that we are living in. And I think it was the UN Secretary General in 2023 that said that we are living in an era of polycrisis. And it is true. The crises that we see now are not a consequence of one type of shock. Many times it's a consequence of many of them converging, whether we're talking about conflict, climate, health, economic shocks. We see many of them converging, and many of them are sadly also converging in urban areas, and especially in low-income countries and in fragile contexts. Here is where we see a lot of the convergence also of displacement and food security. And what is interesting here, and it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, is that food security is both a driver of displacement and also one of the key consequences of displacement. And many times the drivers of displacement and the drivers of food security are also overlapping and are also the same. And I think in this convergence is where I would say the future is. We need to pay more attention to that convergence, those overlapping drivers, in order to have a better response to food insecure populations and to displaced populations. There's lots of ways that the two, food insecurity and displacement, converge. It's not only because food security is a driver and a consequence, but it's also, we're seeing that the majority of the countries that are hosting the majority of IDPs are also facing acute levels of food insecurity. And this is not a coincidence, as I mentioned, no, because their drivers are very much overlapping. Of course, within WFP, a large percentage of the people that we serve in the countries where we work are IDPs themselves, and are affected by food insecurity. Now, one interesting aspect, bringing it back to urban, I would say is that, yes, you have this convergence of displacement and food security. You also have the convergence of the urbanization trend. And I mean, I can give you a very simple example. When we have large percentage of people being displaced from rural to urban areas, this also affects the production of food. We see that in Burkina Faso, where a lot of the displaced population come from rural areas and they go and seek refuge and safety in urban areas. By doing so, you have productive land not being utilized for food production. And where does the demand for food come from? From urban areas. Now, IDPs are going there and urban areas are growing in themselves as well, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. So how are you going to fulfill that demand if agricultural land is not being cultivated? So here you have a situation where the displacement itself affects availability of food by affecting, of course, the production of food in this particular context and the availability of food, including in urban areas where the internally displaced persons would seek refuge in. The other side of the coin is the displaced persons themselves, whether they come from the rural area or other urban centers, arriving to the city, having lost their assets, having lost their land, a very important asset, and livestock. And they come into the city with a completely different set of skills to be able to make a living. Of course, they cannot be self-sufficient in terms of food. They actually have to familiarize themselves with a completely different type of economy and labor market. Particularly in cities, food security in this context, in an urban context, is not anymore about the livestock and their land and making their land productive, but it's actually tied very much to a cash-based economy. They need money to be able to access food, enough food, and also good quality food. So this puts, of course, IDPs in a very difficult situation, having lost their assets, having gone through very challenging journeys, sometimes having lost documentation that is key to access certain services and having to find a place to live, having to pay rent when before perhaps they didn't have to. All of these affects, of course, how they can access enough food. Sometimes they are affected as well by less freedom of movement, access to basic services, and so on. Another interesting intersection that we can see perhaps in other regions, in the Horn of Africa, for example, extreme weather events are, of course, drivers of displacement in the region, which is causing, of course, movements from rural to urban areas, and especially rural to urban, because many of these events relate to drought and to flooding. And of course, households can be seek refuge and in urban areas because of this. So you see now, we're not talking only about conflict, we're also talking about extreme weather events, slow and sudden onset shocks, urbanization, and displacement. All of these converging in many of the regions where I have worked before. I don't know if you noticed in what I was saying before, but there was a lot of rural versus urban, or one affecting the other in different ways. And I want to bring here a phrase that is quite common for urban planners, for specific agencies like UN Habitat and so on, but perhaps not so common when we're talking about displacement. But this rural-urban relationship is extremely important in the type of crisis that we're seeing now. It's important when we talk about the environment. It's important when we talk about food systems, the relationship between rural production and the urban demand that is increasing. By the way, 75% of the demand for food actually comes from urban areas. And this is going to increase to 85% by 2050. So imagine the importance of having enough production in rural and peri-urban areas to serve that demand. But at the same time, we have all the crises on top of that, like displacement, environmental degradation, rapid expansion, encroaching into productive land. So that relationship between rural and urban is one that we also have to explore more to understand how to better respond to food security and link to displacement, because there's a very important connection between rural and urban. Many, as I mentioned before, of internally displaced persons are seeking refuge in urban areas coming from the rural. What is the impact of that on food security? What is the impact of that on the economies of the countries that are affected by this and so on? So that relationship between the two, I think, is worth discussing, not perhaps in this podcast, but one that I would really encourage researchers working in this area to look at from this perspective, from internal displacement linked also to food security as well. And we see currently in discussions related to food system how important it is to strengthen these linkages, particularly in context of conflict, affected by conflict and extreme weather events, because of the multiple consequences that they have, specifically for food security in the area that I'm working at the moment.
Just the last question for you then, Isis. You shared these really interesting intersections between IDPs, urbanization, and food. What would be your advice for different actors working in this space?
Thank you, Romola. All of these are very interesting questions. I'm sure we could talk for a whole day about them, but I'll try to be forward-looking in my answer. But I think to start, I can give the example of the work that I'm doing with WFP right now, because I mean, WFP is one of the largest, or the largest actually, humanitarian agency in the UN system. And I was quite happy when I was tasked to embed an urban lens to its work. Of course, we're talking about a huge organization with operations across 80 countries. And when I say operations, I don't mean just presence in the establishing an office, but actually delivering programs, many of them for in life-saving situations and others related to resilience and building human capital. So reflecting on what the urbanization trend means for the mandate of such an agency is, for me, it would be the first advice. I think especially the key stakeholders responding to internal displacement, first, that they acknowledge that urban areas and urbanization, it's increasingly important to address displacement, because it's where the majority of IDPs are residing and are seeking refuge. And then how to do that in a way that it of course, maintains the mandate of that agency and delineates very clearly what that agency can do in such a context based on its capacities, on its added value, and where it intersects with the work of other actors. So it's very important, especially when we talk about the nexus, that humanitarian development and peace actors understand what they should be doing, where their work stops and where the other begins. We talk a lot about the nexus, but operationalizing that is, I know, is a challenge. So it is quite interesting to see such an agency embedding an urban lens into its programs and reflecting of, especially on what the urbanization trend means for food security. And of course, this relates to IDPs, because many of the food insecure populations are actually internally displaced persons. And I can talk a bit about the strategy. This is an opportunity to perhaps share this work, because it's very much, as you know, important for this intersection we've been discussing for the past half an hour. But this strategy specifically, you know, really try to answer that question. How does urbanization affect food security and nutrition outcomes? And here is where we try to understand how these different trends, is not only urbanization, it's also the fact that cities are becoming, actually inequality is more prevalent in cities than in rural areas. And that inequality in itself is precluding the most vulnerable people access to opportunities. And when we talk about food, as I mentioned some time ago, your capacity to put food in the table very much relies on your capacity to pay for it. And therefore, you need job, you need an income, a source of income that allows you to pay for that food, for enough food and good quality food for your family. So inequality, of course, affects that, as well as the rise in poverty in urban areas. What I mentioned before as well throughout this conversation is how we have all these different types of shocks converging and creating this polycrisis that the UN Secretary General mentioned last year, but also converging increasingly in urban areas. And what we see here is that when these converge in urban areas, we also see that these urban areas themselves are already affected by other development challenges, whether it's lack of service penetration in urban areas where the most vulnerable are settling, or the housing, you know, challenges that are also quite common in urban areas, along other type of urban challenges as well. So we see a convergence of different type of shocks, and we see a convergence of these shocks in urban areas that are already affected by development challenges. So being able to reflect on that and understand how it links to food security was quite important for us with this strategy. And what resulted from this is actually a framework that allow us to respond to the challenge in different ways through our humanitarian efforts and life-saving efforts, but also through our efforts to build human capital, to build resilience. And very importantly, for both the displacement challenge and food security challenge, through the support to national systems and national governments, is extremely important, especially in urban areas where we have different actors already in place and systems in place to support these systems and not duplicate them and not become a parallel actor, but actually always try to work through those systems and through those actors. And by doing that, we're complementing efforts, avoiding duplication, but also we are hoping, hopefully building more resilient local systems. So many of the trends that we've been discussing during this conversation are not going anywhere anytime soon. I mean, just with the urbanization trend itself, it's only accelerating in many of the regions, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, even though many of the countries are still primarily rural, they also have, many of them, the highest rate of urbanization. This means, of course, that they're urbanizing, and they're urbanizing very, very fast at a pace that is difficult to manage, especially for local and national governments, and have repercussions across many other areas, including food security. So that's definitely a trend that we just need to acknowledge is there. Is there to stay, and we need to be forward looking on how we work with it. Another trend, of course, is internal displacement. IDMC, in their last report in 2023, recorded the highest number of IDPs. And that number itself probably doesn't really reflect the magnitude of internal displacement, because it's quite difficult sometimes in many of the contexts to get the accurate data. That's another trend that is not going anywhere. And of course, we can talk about climate change compounding into this challenge, as well as conflict and the polycrisis that we've been mentioning so far as well, all this convergence. So it's not going anywhere. So it's important to start thinking, how do we work better, not only now, but also in the future? And in some of the areas we identify in the urban strategy with WFP, first of all, is that we have to work better together. When you're talking about polycrisis, you're talking about huge challenges with very different topics that require very different disciplines involved. It requires very different capacities involved. I think we really need to stop just talking about it, but actually doing it, testing it in places where we can maximize the efforts, we can maximize the impact and encourage more collaborative practice around some of these areas. We also, of course, when you talk about partnerships, we need to be better at partnering with local governments and supporting local governments in the process. There's a lot of discussion about that. I'm sure other colleagues can talk better about that topic, but I keep saying it because we still need to get better at it. Another area that I think requires quite a lot of work on is on data. And data is a challenging topic, both for urban displacement and for urban food security. The two are very much related, and it's not surprising that it's difficult to get data in urban areas. We know that including intra-urban data and disaggregated data sometimes is quite expensive to get, particularly in low-income countries or urban areas that are largely informal. So there's lots of challenges of getting data in urban areas, but it's not an excuse to try to get a better picture of the situation of IDPs in urban areas and the situation of food insecurity in urban areas. So this is an area, of course, that I'm really encouraging people that are listening, especially researchers and agencies that have the power to and capacity to get that data, to work together on that. Particularly on urban food security, I have to mention, it also relates to the fact that a lot of the indicators and frameworks that we have globally are looking at food security from almost a purely rural perspective. And we have been discussing so far in this conversation, that access to food in rural areas is very different from urban. It's completely different situation and therefore requires different type of indicators. Another area that I already mentioned, and I'm going into now my advice for different actors working in this area, is this rural-urban relationship. And what does that mean for our work on food security, our work on food systems? But also, what does it mean for displacement? I haven't seen it so far that discussed when it comes to internal displacement. And I think it would be an interesting area to expand the discussion and to intersect, particularly when, of course, I'm biased when we're talking about food security of displaced populations. Perhaps linked to my last point, I think we really should make a concerted effort to look for areas and places of opportunity that allow us to get answers for how to respond better to these converging challenges, but also how to anticipate them and prepare better for the longer term future as well. We're looking at Sub-Saharan Africa. I mentioned this before, where some of the countries are still primarily rural, but urbanizing quite quickly. That's an opportunity in itself. It is a challenge because of the rate of urbanization, but it's an opportunity to do things better and not wait until we have larger cities, large informal settlements, large areas concentrating vulnerable people. We can act now to support rural transformation, to ensure that rural areas become also places of opportunities for the people that want to remain there, and at the same time manage growth better in the urban centers. So I see a lot of need to focus more on those places of opportunity to test things and do things differently. And this is important for our conversation today on internal displacement, is important for our conversation on food security and on urbanization itself. So I hope that we see more of that willingness to really try making things differently in the way that we manage cities, in the way that we design our responses, in the way that we work with displaced populations as well. Another area and linked to this is that when we talk about urbanization and urban challenges, we always we tend to think of cities as these very large urban centers and metropolitan areas. But actually, where most of the urban growth is happening is in smaller towns and secondary cities. I mean, you can take the example I mentioned before in Sudan. The towns hosting the IDPs were not large centers. At least they didn't start like that. And eventually they evolved into larger centers, but they still were considered secondary towns, intermediary towns. discussions around the importance of secondary towns and intermediary towns has been there for a while, but I haven't seen that much emphasis on them from the perspective of displacement and from the perspective, for example, of food security. And I think that these are also other places of opportunity to test and try to do things differently, particularly for the discussion we're having today. These smaller towns tend to be the first place of refuge for displaced populations, and at the same time play a huge role, an important role, in the food system. No, they are basically the connector between the larger urban centers that we're used to discuss and the rural areas. So how we can maximize their geographical location, the role that they have in the food system, and the role that they have for supporting IDPs and hosting IDPs, how we can maximize that particular role and support them better. They're also very neglected. They're neglected many times by their own national governments in favor of larger towns. So that's particularly an area, the type of urban centers that require more support from all kinds of actors, humanitarian development and government actors. So I would see that as a place of opportunity, and that we should be mentioning more in these particular discussions, particularly for the type of intersection we discussed today that is quite complex and layered.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today, Isis. I think you've brought up a lot of really interesting and important points, a lot of intersections, as we've mentioned in this podcast, that are very important to consider these discussions around internal displacement, food, urbanization, and how they manifest themselves quite differently in different contexts and in quite different ways, looking at different scales as well. There's a lot to reflect on here, and I'm sure that, you know, we can probably have a much longer conversation about this. But I wanted to thank you for your time today and for sharing all your experiences and your advice with us as well. So thank you again.
Thank you, Romola, for having me, and very interesting conversation, and glad to see internal displacement being discussed from very different lenses through this podcast series that you have. So a pleasure to contribute to it.